Welcome back to WNST, Towson Baltimore and Baltimore Positive. During a Steelers week, in a Ravens season, and an election week, we have merged the streams of 2.5 decades of sports coverage at AM 1570 with all of our work at Baltimore Positive. We're going back through some of our greatest hits and some of our best guests, and we're going to be doing that momentarily. We've picked up some sponsors since the last time we got together with this guy over some crab cakes at Fadley's, which you can still ship and are delicious. But Taharka Ice Cream now with us. This used to be the peanut butter cup. I ate it. There is a new flavor this week. It is Black is Beautiful. It is a chocolate stout in conjunction with Monumental Brewing. So I'm going to be getting a little pint of that next week. I'm also going to be getting the apple crisp as well as the eggnog at Peppermint Bark. They're local. They're going to be shipping it to you. We're going to tell every Baltimore Positive viewer, friend, podcaster, and even Don Moeller's friends are going to get a discount on some ice cream during the holiday season. I am wearing the El Guapo shirt. It's not because I like the color green or love Mexico or Mexico. I love all the above. But I'm wearing that because they are now the adjunct to our friends at State Fair over in the Ville at 21228. Some margaritas, some carnitas, and some delicious, just some delicious fare from the Latin cuisine. My friends over there in the 21228, make sure you say hello to Evan at El Guapo. And, of course, Moeller Gary Realty. Jeff Moeller will be joining us next week. We're going to be talking about the real estate market going into the holiday and after the election. Don, you've pulled out all the big players in the Rolodex here. I will allow you to do the honors. You know, I thought when I got the book out today and fingered through it that you would not have the book.
This is a good book, Governor.
No, it's an awesome book. I love that book.
I hear there's a handbook to go along with it.
Is there a new? Is there a handbook now to go along with this, Governor O'Malley?
It's the workbook. It is the paint-by-numbers version of how to govern for results in the information age.
He knew I was going to run for mayor. That's why he put that together.
That's right. Welcome. It's not that hard. You know, the truth is, good mayors are usually C students. You have to be if you're too intelligent, it's really hard to do the job well.
Well, we welcome back former mayor and governor of Maryland, Martin O'Malley, Baltimore.
Who's clearly
positive.
Heard the show and defined Baltimore. Me as a C student.
A C student.
Baltimore well, I'm, it's positive. Teacher's Month here, Gov, so I've had on.
I was talking about myself, Nestor.
Oh, okay, fair enough. Student. That's good. Okay, good.
Hey, Baltimore, still hope. Baltimore Positive alum. You know, Governor, we're gonna run short on this segment. There's so much talk about, so much at stake. But before we do get into this election, I was thinking you are really one of the few people who can give us a unique perspective on the last week, 4, 5 days, 3 days prior to an election. And what it feels like for the candidate, what it feels like for family and friends. You've worked for 18 months, 2 years. You're getting daily internal polls. I know how I feel, and I'm not running. I mean, I'm having trouble sleeping. So for those who are listening, describe the last week. When someone is a candidate on their family, their friends, and personally, what's happening in Joe Biden's life right now?
Well, I would imagine, I mean, it's hard. This is such an unprecedented, we use the word unprecedented so much, it's become a cliche in this pandemic for politics. But I can tell you that for me and my family at the end of tough campaigns in the stretch, you reach a point your body can kind of sense and your mind can sense that the finish line is coming. At the same time, your veins are so pumped with adrenaline that you reach this point of, I don't know what the word is, Don, just a sense of satisfaction that you've left everything on the playing field. And I can recall anyway that reaching this point in the campaign and feeling like I'm on fumes, you know, I am going with very little effort. I have never given a better living room talk in my life or a better rally talk than you're able to give in that final week. And I found myself overcome during those final days with an enormous, enormous and very profound sense of gratitude that so many people were putting so much on the line and trusting me to kind of, you know, carry the flag at the front of that movement, if you will. I remember being just overcome oftentimes with almost, you know, tears of gratitude that my wife and my kids and my friends and so many people, many of whom I hardly knew, were just putting it all out there for me. And I'm sure Vice President Biden, you know, has that feeling, you know, multiplied larger than anybody can almost imagine.
You know, Don's had a lot of guests this week, and you said Joe Biden, it's over your shoulder, and we'll talk about a million things here, but the election's the most important thing. Tell me about how you know Joe. You know Joe Biden how well, and give me the Joe Biden you know.
Yeah, sure. I had the honor to work with him and get to know him fairly well when I was a governor. I was during the time that he was vice president, and especially when he was first elected. I actually wrote a piece recently about this. With the Recovery and Reinvestment Act, way back when, coming out of the last recession, it was a big stimulus. There was a big part of that stimulus was done, recall, for auto industry and also for to keep the banks from collapsing, neither of which was particularly popular at the time. But and then there was a third piece, and that was to keep cities and county governments and states from adding to the economic misery by laying off teachers and firefighters and police. So that Recovery and Reinvestment Act was predicted to, you know, it's a lot of money, and many of the naysayers were saying, oh, there's going to be an enormous amount of waste, fraud, and abuse. But I saw Joe Biden step up, embrace the tools of this modern information age, namely geographic information systems and the internet, to really take the bull by the horns. To you heard the vice president say in some of those in the two debates that we've listened to, you heard him oftentimes punching through the phrase, Nestor, you just have to bring people together. And some people have shrugged that off and said, oh yeah, it's like kumbaya, bring people together for church or synagogue. That's not what he was talking about. What he was remembering was what he did in the Recovery and Reinvestment Act, which was to bring governors together every couple of weeks to ask, why is this program moving, but this one's not? Why are these dollars helping people, but these dollars are still stuck? And he did that with a degree of openness and transparency, literally a map of the United States where any citizen anywhere could put their address in and see within a mile radius, 2 mile radius, 5 mile radius, quarter mile radius, where were the shovel-ready projects happening? Where was the weatherization projects happening? And so the Joe Biden I know, I said this once to him on a train ride back from Philadelphia. You know it's a true story, Don, right? When you say I was on a train ride with Joe Biden.
Well, yeah, you know, if you were on Amtrak, you know Joe, yes.
So we were coming back from an announcement in Philadelphia, something having to do with the Department of Justice. Eric Holder was there. But on the way back, as we were talking about the things that were working and the things that weren't moving fast enough with recovery and reinvestment, I said to the then vice president, I said, man, I think you missed your calling. I think you would have made a great mayor. And I could tell by his blank response that he wasn't sure how to take it. And I had to say, no, I meant that as a compliment, because you are inclined to be open and transparent, and you're not afraid to ask the questions for which you sometimes don't know the answers. And that's what good mayors do, you know, and good county executives, Don. Your job isn't to be the smartest person in the room. Your job is to bring focus and convene people and get and have the courage to ask the right questions and to give others the permission to ask the right questions and voice the right concerns. So I know that's how Vice President Biden believes we can meet as a nation and as a planet the very ambitious but necessary goals we have on renewable energy. It is going to be an iterative process if, you know, God willing, and the people's voice is heard. Joe Biden is president. I see him bringing a new way of governing, very entrepreneurial, iterative, based on the latest evidence of what's happening when and how we can accelerate those actions.
Well, you know, Governor, you really, I think, nailed there what have been your observations about Vice President Biden. This week in my inbox, an essay from you showed up. And I just want to read the last part of that essay. To me, really captures, I guess, where we can go and where we haven't been. In the very last paragraph, you write this. You say, here's how the vice president is going to govern. You say, model, measure, and map. Set benchmarks, milestones, and deadlines. Bring people together to get things done. Lift up the leaders. Find better ways to make it work and better ways to build back better. I mean, when I read that and that showed up, I thought, we've done none of that in the past year, certainly 3 years, 3.5 years. But in the past 8 months when we really needed it, we've done none of that, have we, Governor?
Yeah, it's been an obscene masquerade of kind of faux or pretend governance. You can't really even call it governance. It's a strange sort of reality TV show that we've been treated to as Americans. We deserve better. You know, Don, we are living in a time of such diminished trust. And ironically, it was that lack of trust in our leaders, that lack of trust in our institutions, lack of trust that the economy would work for me and my kids like it had worked for my dad's generation. It was that lack of trust that had us as Americans turn, however narrowly, but through the Electoral College, had us turn to someone with Donald Trump's message. It was a message that said, not that tomorrow can be better, but tomorrow will be worse. And therefore, I'm going to put the brakes on tomorrow and do everything I can so that you can keep on hold of your piece of the shrinking pie as long as possible. It's understandable that happened. But it's not consistent with the American character, you know?
Well, that's Governor, I'm going to stop you there. I'm going to jump in and I apologize, but I want you to react to this next one because I think what has me so unhinged about Election Day is when you and all of us keep suggesting, I probably have said 1,000 times without hyperbole, this isn't who we are. Yet, as Mike Barnicle said this morning when I was getting ready to do the show on Morning Joe, he said, what is on the ballot Tuesday is the character of our nation. So I'm concerned that we might find out that this is exactly who we are, and we have much more work to do than we ever thought we had. Talk me off that ledge, Governor.
Fareed Zakaria has said that COVID has been a stress test for governments all around the world. And I believe that Donald Trump has been a stress test for the character of our nation. It's almost as if, he's held a mirror up to our false selves. Now I'm quoting Thomas Merton. He has held a mirror up to our false selves. That self that is all about ego, that self that is all about a craven fear. But that's not the story of the America that I was raised with, Don, and that most people were raised with. We're a people that have a preference for tomorrow. We believe in tomorrow. We might not know history and carry the old grudges from 400 years ago, like a lot of people in European nations and other nations do, but we're a people that wake up facing tomorrow. And that's what we need to do again. If you want to know where a country's headed, you talk to our young people under 25. And if you were to play with one of those electoral college maps, you know, I'm sure we're all doing that, right?
Here's mine. And, yeah, and, I've got it in a spreadsheet.
Governor, every morning I get an update. You know, it's like he's...
If you look at the attitudes of young people under 25, you'd see nothing but a totally blue map. And I am heartened that when you break down some of the polling, and all of us have become very, you know, jaded, jaundiced, cautious of believing any polling. But when you look at the individual questions broken out, on trust, on character, on cares about people like me, empathy, on climate, on COVID, on all of those things, even the economy, Joe Biden is beating Donald Trump on virtually all of those, and it's tied on the economy, which is something else for us to go deeper on. But if you look at people under 25, Biden's winning by a mile. So look, we're going to come through this. Of that, I have no doubt. And hopefully it'll happen sooner.
The result, Governor, just let me stop. Regardless of the result.
No president's permanent. If Donald Trump is here for another 4 years, we will still come through this. One of the characteristics of the spirit is openness to better. So I am open to better days. But I think the vice president's going to win. I feel much better about Biden at this point than I ever did about Secretary Clinton's campaigning. And keep in mind, I was in 20 states for her, Don. I was on Eastern Ohio for a couple of days. I was in Wisconsin twice. I was in Michigan for her. I asked a friend of mine who managed Michigan last time and is now doing a number of states for the vice president, albeit out of Washington, you know, not in state. But I said, what do you notice? Do you notice much of a difference in Michigan today versus Michigan 4 years ago? He said, night and day difference in energy. Night and day difference in energy. We cannot keep yard signs in the headquarters. They're flying out. People are putting them up. And that was not the way things were 4 years ago. So, Governor,
they also had the state house taken over by a militia or whatever they're calling it. And everything that's happened in that state. I mean, I must ask you, you know, that could have been you, right? I mean, that could have been thoughts about that, because there's so many things that have happened since the last time we got together and had crab cakes and we're just talking about little things like who was going to run Baltimore, right?
Yeah, it's crazy stuff. The Michigan militia plot, thank goodness there are people within our federal government that were on top of that and were monitoring that, you know, that terror chatter, and it is, you know, domestic terror. So I'm glad that they got in front of it. I shake my head when I hear Donald Trump mocking it at rallies as if it's part of some sort of stand-up routine and taunting the governor. And I don't understand that. I will never accept or understand that. But yeah, so that's a difference. I thought you were going to say something else, Nestor. The other difference in Michigan and Wisconsin this time compared to 4 years ago is that they now have Democratic governors who believe that we should be making it easier for people to vote and not harder for people to vote. And there were very narrow margins by which Hillary Clinton lost Michigan and Wisconsin last time. Don, I believe that, and Nestor, on a couple scores, when you look at last time and compare it to this time on those critical states of Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, the answer to the question cares about people like me. Joe Biden is doing much better on that than 4 years ago our nominee was doing. You look at Democratic governors across all three of those at a time when the pandemic is making it more difficult for people to vote. At least we have Democratic governors that are making accommodations with mail-in ballots and drop boxes and the like, not to make it harder, but to make it easier. And then finally, the degree to which most Americans, and especially in those states where COVID is spiking most, you know, most dramatically and most in a most deadly way in Wisconsin and those neighboring states, people have connected the presidency and the failure to respond to this pandemic, this being the number one issue, and the two people running for president. So I think we're going to know on election night, and I think it's going to be because of those three states.
Well, Governor, A quick political question, and then I want to jump back because you mentioned COVID, and I want to talk about the response, because I do think there are some lessons in your book, Smarter Government. And again, if you're out there and you care about government, I don't care if you're Democrat, Republican, Independent, Governor O'Malley's book, Smarter Government, really is a must read. It's not a political book. It's a how-to book. It's about how to make government work. And I think everyone would find it a fascinating read.
Hey, but thank you, Don.
Back to the political part of this. You were close. You were a fan early on of Beto O'Rourke. My guess is you know Stacey Abrams and you know what's going on in Georgia. We asked former Congresswoman Edwards this morning if she believed this shift to blue that appears to be evolving over time in Georgia, Texas, and Arizona is real, or is it just stuff that those of us who like to fool with punditry like to talk about? Is that, in your relationship with Beto, is that shift to blue real in Texas?
Yeah, yes, it is. It's really a shift to cities, best understood, I think, or, well, that's one lens through which to understand it. I was talking to Beto O'Rourke just a few weeks ago about Texas, and I said, is it really in play? And he said, yeah, I believe it is. He said, it's, you know, not easy. And he said, but we're going to be within the margin on, he's been, Beto O'Rourke's put all of his energy into his own leadership PAC effort called Powered by People. And so a lot of the ground game in Texas that's happening is happening through Beto O'Rourke's network, all of those people that were so energized when he was running against Ted Cruz. He's kind of redirected that to a ground game in a time when doing ground games is very hard by Zoom. But they've been making a lot of calls and doing a lot of things. But back to your question, I was campaigning in the midterms all over the country for candidates, mostly running for state house and state senate. And I was in Georgia, and I campaigned personally for Stacey Abrams and also for her lieutenant governor, Sarah Riggs Amico. And I was at a fundraiser for a congresswoman, Carolyn Bordeaux, that was co-hosted by my friend Jason Carter, who was Jimmy Carter's grandson, who ran for governor down there, ran an awesome race. But as Jason pointed out to me, the metro areas of Georgia are growing and their diversity is increasing. And the number of people with talent and skills and energy and degrees that are moving to Atlanta and the Atlanta suburbs is such that the demographics of Georgia overall is changing because cities are growing. That's a global phenomenon. That's not just in the United States. Don and Nestor, if you were to have looked at a map, a color-coded map, blue and red, of the last election colored in by county, it looked like a sea of red with little dots of blue. If you adjusted that map to look at where the population was, it looked like a bunch of blue bubbles with deep crevices of red in between. So that's the movement of humanity on the globe. We passed a threshold in 2012 where a majority of us Homo sapiens, human beings, now live in cities and metro areas for the first time in human history. And that's only going to continue to grow. And that's going to happen in this country. And that's why probably Democrats are also going to pick up 7 more seats in the House this time.
Governor O'Malley, you mentioned all of the the issues going on in Georgia and legitimate things. Let's go back to where you were about 6 minutes ago, which is suppress the vote, right? Like, that is the thing we're seeing with lines. It's the thing we're seeing with the dismantling of post offices by fiat. I mean, it's crazy stuff that's happened here, and now we're up against, will our vote be counted? Will the state start counting the votes on Tuesday or after Tuesday? He's going to declare victory by what, 10 p.m. on Tuesday night? We know that playbook, right? No, he will declare victory on Twitter.
He learned that from Bob Ehrlich.
Yeah, so we know that, right? So from the suppress the vote part of this, it's very, very clear there is a movement on the entire side, not just gerrymandering and things that citizens don't know about or don't pay attention to. They do pay attention to, I want to go vote for the next president, and how the hell do I do it, and what do I have to do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the voter suppression stuff with the essentially the repeal of the Voting Rights Act has I mean, this has almost become an accepted tool in the campaign arsenals of Republican governors and the Republican Party or what's been made of it.
Well, you mentioned Stacey Abrams. Forever, I will equate her with that.
Yeah, it's amazing the degree, the shamelessness, really, with which, I mean, look in our own state. In the primary, our state was able to mail all of us ballots. We filled them out and we sent them back. But they saw that too many of us voted when it was made that easy. So instead, in the general election with Donald Trump on the ballot, Larry Hogan decided that we needed to apply first for a ballot and then they would send it to us. Well, why did we need to have a two-step process in the general when they sure as hell, with more candidates on the ballot, figured out how to mail us a ballot?
During a plague, by the way. Let's put that part in.
Yeah, during a plague. So, and lots of people, I guarantee you, like my wife, well-educated woman who reads a lot every day.
We call her the judge. We credit her as Judge O'Malley.
So let me, I don't want to get her in trouble. So let me just say there were many people saw that official mail come in the door and said, that's my ballot, just like for the primary. I'm going to put it up here, you know, where we keep the bananas in the bowl above the refrigerator, and I'll fill it out close to the election. And then they get close to the election, they open it up, and they realize, oh, holy shnikes, I needed to apply this time? Why do I need to apply this time when I didn't need to apply for the primary? So little insidious things like that, or you have to show an ID, or if you're requesting it, you have to make sure that you did this, that, or the other thing in order to vote. It's outrageous. And well, as long as we're on the topic, I also find it absolutely outrageous that without a whimper of objection from the Democratic Party of Maryland, that Larry Hogan named a major highway after the only governor in Maryland history to have his campaign manager and his deputy campaign manager criminally convicted in a federal court, one of them serving a jail term for black voter suppression. That governor was Bob Ehrlich, and Larry Hogan named a major highway after him, even after those convictions. So it's almost as if we've become immune to voter suppression. And hopefully, that's something that the next generation can help us fix as well.
Well, several points to respond to there, Governor. One, to build on your, Nestor and I have covered extensively on this program what we thought was just a decision that made no sense, what you talked about, to create a two-step process when the one-step process worked very, very well.
Really and well.
It was the only option that every local board of elections in the state opposed. Although they couldn't reach consensus, they said, don't give us
a consensus.
Yeah, that was a consensus. Don't give us a two-step process.
What citizen wanted that? What citizen would say, yeah, we want that?
Yeah,
it's outrageous. And then look at what happened or what is happening in Florida, because I think it's really illustrative of what happens in the nation. And my Republican friends get so angry, and you and I have Republican friends, and I have Republican relatives. They get so angry when I give this example. But I tell them, guys, you cannot want it to be true, but it's true. So Republican voters say that once you've been to jail, you've paid your debt to society, and you come out, and we want you to be a viable part of society again, you should then exercise your right to participate in our democracy. You should be able to vote. The voters made that clear in Florida. Republican legislature says, no, not so fast. If you have some fees and other things that you owe the state, you can't vote until those are clear. So Mike Bloomberg steps in and says, give me the list. I'm going to pay them all off. so they can all vote. And now the legislature says, well, nah, not so fast, because they've got to be processed and we're not going to be able. I mean, if you read that in a novel, you would think that could not be true, right? I mean, it's overt. It's not even subtle.
Boy, Orwell and Huxley would be having fun with us now, wouldn't they?
Yeah, oh, my goodness. It's not even subtle. Well, going back to making government work, and again, I want to take you back to February and March when we began to realize we had a worldwide pandemic on our hands. And I went back and reread your chapter on the Howard Street Tunnel fire. That great day, that day when you thought your chief of staff said, you know, everything's on fire, you thought it was metaphorically.
You were like eating crabs at Chris Field or something like that.
Yeah, I was coming back from Chris Field. He said, we've had a bit of a train wreck. I said, I knew they'd screw up that library.
A train wreck. No, we've had a real train wreck. But my question for you, Michael Enright aside for a minute, my question for you is, if Martin O'Malley had been president at the time instead of Donald Trump, what lessons would Martin O'Malley have brought to the table that he learned as mayor from the Howard Street Tunnel that would have helped us better manage and fight COVID? What did you learn from the Howard Street Tunnel that you would have applied that Donald Trump should have applied?
Yeah, I think in any big emergency, there's only a few questions that every chief executive, whether it's a mayor or president on a pandemic, has to answer for the people. And that is, what's happening? What do you know about it? What are you doing about it? And what should me and my family be doing to protect ourselves? Donald Trump failed on each of those four. He did none of those things. He did not tell us truthfully what was happening, even though he had the benefit of the best intelligence apparatus in the free world and the best scientists. He decided to ignore it rather than do something about it. Instead of kicking into motion the powers of the presidency, the Defense Production Act, and getting out the personal protective equipment and the like, he failed to do any of those things until the bodies started being put in body bags in such numbers that he couldn't deny anymore that something was happening. He did close travel to China, give him that one, but he didn't do any of the other things, and he failed to tell us truthfully what we should have done, which was to wear masks. And he still fails to do that. In fact, he's the super spreader in chief. I have no doubt that Joe Biden would have handled that emergency much differently. You know, Dom, when we would do tabletops, I was appointed by President Obama to a little known entity called the Council of Governors. It is the job of those, I think it's six governors, by act of Congress, to meet regularly and work with Department of Defense, Department of Homeland Security, HHS, you know, Health and Human Services, in order to better coordinate response to protect the homeland, whether it's from mega hurricanes or mega tornadoes or from pandemics. And in all of the tabletops and scenarios where we would discuss pandemic, it was always assumed the president would tell us truthfully what was happening. It was always assumed that as soon as the president got word, we would get a jump on a coming pandemic and put into motion the industrial complexes of the United States in order to bring up our defense shields and to protect people. We never dreamed in any of those scenarios that the president would see it coming and decide not to tell us or discourage us from preparing for it.
He doesn't believe in science, right? Like the thing that became very apparent to me early on is he really didn't sort of understand the eighth grade biology of this. Like literally, I don't think intellectually he really understood it or understands it.
Yeah, I don't know if it's that or if he's a man who has been so successful at creating alternative stories and riding those stories, including riding into the White House, that he thought he could create an alternative story about this that would have us regard it or equate it as something like a seasonal flu. hey, man, you can say what you want about the guy, but he did manage to get to the White House. So his talent for spinning alternative stories had a pretty long run, but he couldn't spin his way out of this virus.
Do you really think we were capable as a society? And I know you've traveled the world. My wife and I think we got COVID. We were in Korea. We were in Japan in late December, right before we saw you, quite frankly, the turn of the year. Mm. And my wife is very sick. I think when you did the show with us and, you know, in the hospital, in and out, whatever, we didn't know what it was. No, she's cool. We're all, the notion that you're immune to it or whatever we've been living under with masks over the last 8 months. But I often now wonder, I didn't wonder this in March, but I do wonder our society and where we are, whether we were ever capable with your leadership, Oprah, Hillary, Obama, JFK, whoever leading you, Churchill, leading America in 2020, whether we really, listening to scientists, taking Fauci to heart, whether we were capable of tracing and doing it the way that your round table would have said, like in the movie, this is what has to be done. We have to lock down. I find it amazing that back in February, January, when something happened in Wuhan, when the news happened, you'd see the meat wagon show up. Everybody's in the white suit. They bring the body out. Woo, woo, woo. Now, like flash forward 8 months later, and this cat with the Dodgers contracts it in the middle of the game and is diving on the pile out in the middle of a World Series. I mean, how we've treated this thing versus the way China and the way the Far East treated this in the very, very beginning. Yeah. But I'm wondering, as a society, even with great leadership, could we have really mitigated this thing, or would we be wearing masks anyway?
Yeah, I don't know if Oprah were president. But, but I can tell you, we are absolutely capable of addressing this, but leadership does matter. We're doing a worse job than any other developed nation on the planet. I mean, this is not a matter of, we're doing worse than everybody else. So certainly we're better than we can do better than worse. So what does that mean in real terms? Does that mean instead of 200,000 people dead, we'd only have 100,000 dead? Yeah, maybe. But Nestor, and there's not a doubt in my mind that we could have, should have, and will soon do a better job of addressing this pandemic. I wrote a piece about 4 or 5 months ago, I guess it is now, Don, about contact tracing and the way that cell phone location technology could be combined with the map and the internet in order to do a much better job of identifying early and isolating and containing this. And so far, talking to a good friend of mine at Johns Hopkins, who has a pretty global view of things and certainly a countrywide view of what's going on in our nation, I said, is anybody doing contact tracing well? And he said, honestly, no. He said, New York's doing better than most, but that might just be the scale at which they're trying to do it. But that's what happens, Nestor, when the leader denies that a pandemic is happening, when it's all about shift and blame. Oh, let the governors own the closures. We're going to own the opening. When there's denial and blame and excuses at the center, nobody feels any pressure to do better. But when we have a president, again, who is challenging all of us to do better, who is bringing together governors and mayors and county executives and saying, what can we do in order to improve contact tracing? What do you need? What are the tools? What is the training? And how can we do better? There's not a doubt in my mind that we will put this pandemic down, but we need new presidential leadership to do it. We're not going to do it with a president that denies it's happening and who turns our own White House into a hotspot location for COVID transmission.
Amen. We are with former Mayor of Baltimore and Governor of Maryland, Martin O'Malley, working hard to elect Joe Biden on November the 3rd. I'm laughing when Nestor talks about Oprah as president, governor. I'm trying to think, what does that look like? Is it like, you get a test, you know, Oprah's just throwing out the test. We can only wonder. Looking again, it's the hardest question, and it's unfair to ask our guests, but we keep asking them to try to unpack this question. win or lose next week, Donald Trump is going to get somewhere in the vicinity of 70 million Americans. Roughly 70 million Americans, give or take, on either side of that ledger, are going to say that despite all of this bombast and despite all of the making fun of a disabled reporter and grabbing women by the by their private parts and the mishandling of COVID and calling veterans suckers, despite all of that, they're going to say, you know, I think he's still my guy. Governor, you've been at this since a young man. You've been all over the country campaigning. You have won four hard elections. Try, as I said to former Congresswoman Edwards, can you take the emotion out of it and try to analyze, as somebody who studies politics, what is it? What's gone wrong in our country that 70 million people think this guy's the solution to our problems? Who are these folks? And I don't mean that negatively. I mean it genuinely. What has happened to make them feel that way?
Yeah, that man, there's a lot of thoughts that go through my mind. Shortly after the last election, I happened to be in Germany for a big international political conference, and I went on behalf of the DNC in that awkward, weird interim time. But a member of the German military, who even knew the Germans had a military, after a few of us were sitting around the table and talking, he pulls me aside and he says, "May I ask you a question without intending any offense?" And I said, "Sure." And in his German accent and his German military uniform, he said, "Could you explain to me how it is that 63 million of your fellow Americans could have voted for a man and a candidacy like this?" I shared that story more recently with my youngest son. And he said, "You should have said to him, 'You know how.'"
Yeah.
We are not so much better than the Germans of the 1930s were. On another occasion, I found myself in China, and there was a member of the Chinese Politburo there. We were there as Democrats and Republican delegation that was started a number of years back to improve relations. And he asked a question in a different sort of way. Again, preface with, "I mean no offense. May I ask you a question?" And he said, "How is it that Americans seem to have become so afraid of the future when that runs counter to everything we thought we understood about the American character?" So, Don, this is my take. Having traveled through a lot of states right after Donald Trump's election and up into the midterms, thanks to friends supporting me and my ability to help other people that were running to win back their own states and win back our Congress, I found in the talks I gave at JJ dinner, you know, the Democratic dinners and the like, or living rooms, initially 90% of my remarks were focused on Donald Trump and 10% about us. By the end of that odyssey and traveling through 30 different states for over 50 candidates, I found that that it totally switched. And 90% of my talk was about us, about what we can do, about making tomorrow better, about keeping faith with the courage of our parents and grandparents, who also faced times of big threats and rapid economic and technological change. But they didn't put their heads in the sand. They had a strong country at their back. They had their neighbors on either side. They faced the future. They won two industrial revolutions, a second world war, and oh, by the way, won the peace afterwards. And they didn't do it by defunding their country. They didn't do it by sticking their neighbors' kids in cages on our border. No, they did it by facing the future and doing the tough work necessary. And they had the leadership that made it happen. So I believe the reason why so many people have fallen under this guy's Svengali cult-like trance is that a lot of Americans have become afraid of the future. They believe that inevitably their children's lives are going to be worth less in a global economy with global challenges and a more diverse America. And let's be quite honest with one another. White people act strangely when they think they're about to become a minority in their church, in their neighborhood, in their county, or in their country. And there's a lot of that that's going on right now, too. Not the first time it's happened in our country, but it is the first time that anybody managed to take over, hijack a major party's nomination by riding that fear of the future. So that's my take on it, Don.
Can I ask you, you obviously have some people on the other side of the aisle that you still keep some semblance of relationship. We all do, during these trying times. Where do you find the middle as sort of a lifetime negotiator and bringing people together and trying to bring people together? Because at some point, when all this is over with, I need to get along with some people that maybe I haven't gotten along with so well to think about, all right, 3 years, 5 years, 8 years, are some of these people going to come back into my life in some way? Because there have been some incredible over-the-line things for me that have divorced me from people that I used to think, thought I knew you better than that. That my people are from Venezuela. My people came here on a boat. Are you out of your mind?
Yeah.
Do I applaud you for your antics in Georgetown for the second time?
It was the Dubliner.
I want to go there and have a drink with you one night to honor you. Yes.
It was near my high school. Yeah, Cuccinelli.
You told that one last time.
So I think a lot of us have had that experience over these last 4 years, Nestor. I thought I knew them. I thought our kids went to school together. I thought I knew them.
Bob Ehrlich was at my wedding, and I ran into him in the casino at Christmas last year, and it was right around your Cuccinelli period, and my wife said, oh, my God. We had a moment because I had to tell him, not on your team, bro. Sorry. Embarrassed. And that's me to a governor in a casino, because that's how I just had to say to him, I can't believe you're standing for this.
Yeah, Bob likes to gamble, especially with other people's money. I think the vice president in this campaign has been, and Kamala Harris, have been remarkably disciplined about not falling into the trap of vilifying everyone who voted for Donald Trump or everyone who is open to voting for Donald Trump. I think without forgiving or accepting as normal some of the many outrageous, cruel-hearted, and un-American things that he has done and continues to do as president in this final gasp with these super spreader events and the reckless endangerment of other people's lives, I think it's going to be very important after this election that we do restore the soft ties that unite us as a people. And I believe that the vice president is a leader capable of doing that. He has the heart and he has the compassion. He has the empathy. And I think you will see him do that. But each of us is going to have a role in doing that as well. Somehow we need to get through this. The best, great countries sometimes make really bad mistakes, but in democracies, good people get to correct those mistakes quickly. That's what we started to do with the midterms when we expressed our votes. And that's what we should consider ourselves very fortunate to be able to do peacefully, is to correct that mistake now. I mean, we went, Nestor, for 240 years without electing a despot or a fascist. That's a pretty good run for a democracy. I'm not aware of another democracy on the planet that had a 240-year run.
And it took help from the Russians last time around to get us here.
Yeah, and there's, a lot of new challenges with this openness and the internet and the ability to turn our freedom of speech against us and to weaponize it with micro-targeting and Facebook ads. And we have to learn from that. We have to learn from all of that. But what we also have to be able to remember, it's not a learning, it's not a new learning, it's a remembrance. we have to remember that, in fact, we are all in this together, that we all want really the same thing for our kids and grandkids. We want them to live in a world that's safer, where they have more opportunities than we had, where they're able to live their life to the fullest. And so that's what we need to restore. I don't think it will be so very, very hard. These last 4 years have been hard, but I think the ability to forgive one another is something that is innate and still within us as a people. We only need to, you know, acknowledge the mistake we've made by correcting it, and by embracing the common good we share as children of a loving and forgiving God.
There's that Jesuit training that the Washington Post likes to write about in former Governor O'Malley. His book, Smarter Government.
Hold up the handbook. That's last year's model. Where's
again,
the new
Governor?
Model?
Where's,
come on.
Yeah, where's the
paint by, the paint by numbers?
There you go. The paint by numbers.
The workbook.
If you care
like
about
that.
Government, you want to make it work. You're an administrator, really, in any field, not just government.
Yeah.
You want to pick this up. Governor, does Joe Biden get north of 300 electoral votes, or are we all holding our breath on election night for Pennsylvania to come in?
Yeah, golly, Don. I believe it's 279 on election night. I'm like Lucy and holding the ball for Charlie Brown. I'm not going to believe Florida and Ohio are coming our way.
I have 280. I've got Maine 2 and Nebraska 2 both going to Biden. You buy that?
Yeah, I think that's a very plausible scenario. I think, like I say, my number's been 279, yours is 280. I saw that poll, though, from ABC, the one that came out very recently in Wisconsin, that showed a really dramatic spreading of Biden's lead in a state that's also seeing a dramatic spreading of COVID.
Right.
So, but yeah, I think 279, and I hope I am pleasantly surprised to have been too conservative in my prediction, but I think 279.
Well, we hope to see a Governor O'Malley if it goes the way we want. I know you're loving life, you're loving teaching, you're loving writing, but I know that we personally want to see a Governor O'Malley in a Biden cabinet. And we look forward to that day. You have a lot left.
You're starting rumors, Mueller.
I'm telling you, I just think there are a number of cabinet positions that fit the governor quite nicely. So,
hey, thank you, Don.
Yeah, we thank you for joining us, and we look forward to having you back on after the election.
And I look forward to it as well. And hopefully on the other side of COVID, we can do this at Fadley's again.
There you go.
I hope he doesn't give me the workbook, because if Professor O'Malley gets a hold of me, I better be better than a C to get the workbook to get you back on.
Nestor, you too could be a mayor.
There you go, Nestor.
A minus.
Not hard.
I'm working on it.
Do the job.
Let me get the platform going here first.
Lift up the leaders.
Governor O'Malley joining us here, giving us a little smarter government, along with the workbook and a little look at the election, as well as where we are. A lot has changed since we got together and had that crab cake at Fadley's. A big shout out to our friends at Taharka, as well as State Fair. I'm wearing the El Guapo shirt. Jeff Mueller from Mueller and Gary Realty is going to join us next week on behalf of former Baltimore County Executive Don Mueller. You can find all of our work now at WNST.net, AM 1570. We're streaming live, and of course, at the new platform, Baltimore Positive.